Achilles, Part 1, Macedonian Origins. Alexander the Great is a name all of us with any interest in history can immediately recognize. When I think of him, I conjure images of a great conqueror, a general full of youthful energy, a man of unlimited ambition and a military genius. A great man who was the first European who conquered much of the known world. He's credited with spreading Greek culture and Hellenism to the ends of his empire, ensuring its survival to this day in Western thought. Since his reign, countless great men have been using his life as a benchmark to be weighed against, and often find themselves wanting. One of my favorite stories is the one of Julius Caesar, who wept when reading of Alexander's accomplishments. When asked by his comrades why he wept, he famously responded, "Do you think I have not just cause to weep when I consider that Alexander at my age has conquered so many nations, and I have at all this time done nothing that is memorable?" I think as we age, it's not uncommon to do as Caesar does and worry about how our legacy stacks up against those who came before us. Despite Alexander being such a larger-than-life character, I've never felt like I've truly understood the significance of his life other than in abstract generalities and references. To be fair, there's plenty written on him out there, and my research in the subject has helped fill a lot of the gaps in knowledge while I've been preparing for this podcast. As an avid listener of podcasts, though, I find the field wanting based on my personal listening preferences. I haven't found a podcast that really scratched the itch of understanding Alexander's life, or more broadly, understanding the history of the Macedonian Empire. This isn't to say there aren't some great history podcasts out there that cover parts of what I will cover. They just haven't fulfilled my rampant desire to understand someone who is so frequently referenced in history. So here we go. Before I dive into Alexander the Great, I'm going to start with the origin of the story of Macedonia. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this initially caused a dilemma for me, and I'll lay it out for you. When exploring history, how much context do we need to understand the stories we are told? Many of us raised in the U.S. have a reverence and hopefully a general understanding of the Constitution, our rights, and the institutions which form our government. It isn't practical, or maybe even necessary, for us to understand Enlightenment, political theory, the Magna Carta, or even the Federalist Papers to grasp what the Constitution stands for and how it's relevant today. Now, if you're like me, these things still interest you, and before you know it, you're sucked into some sort of detailed minutia which you may find as a listener completely irrelevant and way too involved. Regardless, it can be cumbersome and frankly boring for a podcast to go too deep. Let me give you an example of how this is relevant to this story. We want to understand the life of Alexander the Great, right? Well, it took Alexander less than 13 years to build the first European empire. By comparison, when doing research on Alexander's father, Philip II, I found that one of the Roman sources on Philip II references the Assyrian Empire, which is the predecessor to the Persian Empire, which Alexander will conquer. And he provides some background around that. And guess what? According to his histories, the Assyrian Empire lasted 1,300 years. Think about that. That's almost 2.5 times longer than the Roman Empire, if you exclude the Byzantines. It's an incomprehensible timeline. The Persian Empire lasted a paltry 220 years before Alexander conquered them. Greek democracy, embodied in the polis of Athens, lasted less than 200 years. Now, we don't have a ton of Assyrian primary sources to go off of, so even if I wanted to tell the story of the Assyrian Empire, it couldn't be done as maybe we'd all hope we could. The point is, we don't need that level of detail to accomplish what we want to with this podcast. So let me do this. I'm going to give you a quick snapshot of the background of the region before I dive into Macedonian history proper. We'll concern ourselves primarily for now with the Persians and the Greeks. The Persians ruled over the area of modern-day Iran, Armenia, Afghanistan, most of Pakistan, modern Turkey and Asia Minor, Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and Egypt. Impressive, right? The empire reaches these heights by around 522 BC. The Persians, under King Darius and later Xerxes, famously came into conflict with the Greeks as the Persian Empire extended into Europe and attempted to conquer Greece. So, let's talk about the Greeks. Hopefully, we have some understanding of where Greece is and what ancient Greece entailed. It was a peninsula dominated by a polis system. A primary city would dominate an area, and that territory around the polis was considered part of that Greek political group. We know many of their names. The Athenians, the Thebans, the Spartans, Attics, Corinthians, the list goes on. We know so much about the Greeks because they have writers like Herodotus, who write things like the histories, and those writings have managed to make it down to us. We have to hand it to the Greeks. They do a great job with PR as far as history goes. Our perception of the Persians invading Greece is that the Persians always end up in a bad way, and that Greece will triumph no matter the odds. I mean, think of 300, right? It's a battle we still deify to this day as the incredible turning point in history where the Spartans lead the ultimate last stand to save Western civilization. I just think of Texan history when I go down to the Bullock Museum where I live in Austin, and you can see Molon Labe up there, loud and proud. From the Persian point of view, the Battle of Thermopylae was no doubt unremarkable, a footnote in history that they would pay no attention to. Regardless of the spin, the point is there are going to be years of struggle between Greece and Persia, and eventually the Persians will be pushed out of Europe, and Athens dominates Greece by forming the Delian League in 478 BC. The League quickly became an excuse to establish hegemony over the Greeks of the Aegean Sea and the coast of Asia Minor by the Athenians. As an aside, you might be surprised, as I was years ago, to hear that much of the coast of Asia Minor was Greek. The peninsula in Greece is a rocky, mountainous area that has limited fertile land that cannot hold a large population with its own local resources. At various points in Greek history, the ancient Greeks are able to sustain a relatively large population through trade empowered by naval prowess, and by relying on slave labor to maintain what fields are available. When a Greek population hit a critical mass, another way of dealing with the pressure of population was to send out colonies along the Mediterranean. These colonies spanned as far west as the Iberian Peninsula in Spain, but more importantly to our story, the Ionians, or Athenian Greeks, inhabited most of the islands in the Aegean and the coastal areas of Asia Minor to include Cyprus, as well as into the Black Sea. It is important not to think of these Greeks as politically a part of a pan-Greek state until Athens comes along and tries to unite them under the Delian League. What's important is that the colonies were culturally Greek and spoke a dialect of Greek and would often associate themselves with their historically founding polis. The Delian League started as a fairly harmonious union, but quickly became a vehicle for Athenian domination and an Athenian empire. The Athenian Empire would hold dominant Greece until 431 BC, when Athenians' harsh rule became too much to bear and the Peloponnesian War broke out. The war pitted the Delian League, led by Athens, against the Peloponnesians, led by Sparta, but including Thebes, who are also known as the Boeotians, and our favorite group, the Macedonians. The Peloponnese is where the Peloponnesians got their namesake, and it's a peninsula at the southwest side of the Greek peninsula, connected by a narrow isthmus at Corinth. The Peloponnesian War lasts until 404, and hails the ascendancy of Sparta, who takes over the dominant Greek empire. Once you know that a giant war between the superpowers of the Greek peninsula exhausts both sides in resources and men, the result is a short-lived victory for a weakened Sparta, as they are supplanted by Thebes in the Battle of Leuctra in 371. Although the timeline I just gave isn't immediately important to our story, I want you to keep it in the back of your mind as we dive into ancient Macedonia. I also want to say now that as we explore Macedonian origins, we aren't going to have the excitement, glory, and drama that we get with Alexander the Great. I think having this background helps us to understand Alexander, though, and makes those stories when they come that much more satisfying. Let's start with this. Where is Macedonia? The question is more important than you might otherwise think. From here on, I want you to understand that geography, along with associated geology and climate, are incredibly important to the history of any group of ancient people. Or any people in general, I suppose. I'm not going to take this to the extreme of Jared Diamond, who makes the claim in his book of Guns, Germs, and Steel that the dominance of Europe in the modern world can be traced to these elements. But Macedon's location on the map defines it. Why? Macedonia is at the geographical crossroads. It's where the Great Balkan landmass intersects with the Greek peninsula. It's the bridge between continental Europe and the Balkan Mediterranean zone. It's the link between the Adriatic, Aegean, and Black Seas. The area has served as an important corridor for migration and trade since prehistory. More important to our upcoming story, it's the link between the West, or Europe and Greece, and the East, or the land across the Hellespont into Asia Minor. If a land army wishes to reach Greece from Asia Minor, they'll have to go through Macedonia. And if, say, an expedition desires to go the other way, the same must hold true. Getting into specifics. The area Macedonians come to occupy stretches from its birthplace in the hills north of Mount Olympus and spreads to include the lowlands along the Thermaic coast, picture northwest Aegean Sea. It encompasses the all-important rivers of Axios and Strymon by the time we get to Alexander the Great's time. This area is the largest and most fertile ground in modern Greece, and to this day is rich in lumber. A source of timber is going to become really important, as the Greeks that are contemporary to the ancient Macedonians had, for most part, deforested their Greek peninsula. I want to make a distinction and call this area that I'm talking about, along the rivers and the Thermaic Gulf and the plains, Lower Macedonia. It's really what I consider Macedonia proper for much of Macedonian history. Macedonia also includes the highland areas to the west of the coastal lowlands. Specifically, the area is north of Thessaly, east of the Pindus Range, and west of the mountains that separate the plains of Lower Macedonia from Upper Macedonia. Mountains including Mount Olympus, Parian, and Mount Birmingham. I'll provide a map on the website empirehistorypodcast.com to shed some light on this. So anyway, the highlands. The highlands area continues to be a great grazing land for livestock outside of winter. It's speckled with mountain lakes and rich in fish and waterfowl. I'm going to call this area Upper Macedonia, an area which becomes the purview of highland lords with flexible allegiance to the Macedonians of the lowlands up until the time of Philip II, Alexander the Great's father, when he will bring them to heel. Who are the Macedonian people? Legend is that Macedonians were descendants of the great Greek god Zeus. The god Helen, from whom the Greeks derived the name for themselves as Hellenes, had three sons and a daughter, Taia. Zeus impregnates Taia and gives birth to two sons, Macedon and Magnes. Macedon settles to the north of Olympus, Magnes settles to the south and becomes Thessaly. Now, outside of legend, Macedonians started as nomadic pastoralists who first reside along a north extension of Mount Olympus, based in the region of Pyria during the 8th and 7th century BC. Pyria means rich land, and it's known for its lush pastures and timber as it slowly slopes into the Thermaic Gulf. Macedonians' pastoralist origins had a lasting impact on their culture. For example, they became great horsemen and enjoyed a rich culture of hunting, to include hunting lions and wild boar. An interesting custom was that you couldn't recline at a banquet unless you speared a wild boar without the aid of a hunting net. They drank undiluted wine, a custom offensive to their Greek neighbors to the south. They differentiated themselves by being ruled by a king, as opposed to an aristocracy, rule of the best, democracy, rule of the people, or oligarchy, rule of the few. These kings were expected to be military leaders who led campaigns personally. I'm going to discuss more about traditions, methods of rule, and the culture of Macedonians in later episodes, so I'll just leave you that as a little taste for now. How did the Macedonians form politically? The tribes that made up the Macedonians started to coalesce in the 8th century under a royal house of the Argidae, the founding dynasty of Macedonia. If you believe the mythology, the rulers had a direct line of descent from the god of Macedon. For whatever reason, the Argidae dynasty fades from power and becomes dominated by a foreign ruling family, the Temenid family, around 650 BC. It's not clear if this happened through uniting the families, but the transition seems seamless. The Temenids taking over is a watershed moment. This is the royal dynasty that rules through Alexander the Great. The Temenids mark the point when Macedonia goes from one of the many hill tribes of the region to growing into unified people that will be a regional superpower. Through conquest, the Temenids slowly grow their power, establish a centralized Macedonian identity, and consolidate their rule by a central king, as opposed to what had been before, which was a band of cooperating warlords. So who were the Temenids? According to Herodotus, the Temenids were three brothers that were exiled from the royal house of Argos, a Greek polis located in the Peloponnesian Peninsula, who are forced to flee to an area of Upper Macedonia. As an aside, I want to mention that the royal house of Argos claimed descent from the Greek god hero Heracles, a claim Alexander would tout as part of his divine pedigree. So what are the name of these brothers? Forgive my pronunciation, I'm going to do my best, but here it is. I'm going to do my best. Gyanes, Arepos, and most importantly, Perdiccas. In Upper Macedon, the brothers worked for a local king, tending horses, cattle, and the younger brother Perdiccas tending to the lesser animals. Interestingly, the king's household was obviously a humble one, as the queen would bake bread for the household. Anyway, every time the queen baked bread for the brothers, the loaf that was served to Perdiccas rose twice as high as all of the others. Clearly, this was an omen the king couldn't ignore. So he summoned all three brothers, ordering them to leave immediately. The brothers protested. After all, they hadn't been paid for their work. The king, seeing the sun streaming through the smoke hall of the house, replied, "I imagine to much amusement, I'll give you this for pay," and pointed the sunlight on the ground. His other brothers were dumbstruck, but of course Perdiccas, without missing a beat, graciously accepted the payment. He took out his short sword and drew a circle around the sunlight, sweeping it three times into his garment. Once the brothers had left, and the king dwelled on what had happened, he became enraged and ordered his horsemen to go out and kill the brothers. The brothers fled across the river and ended up joining the Macedonians ruled under the Argidae. If you're wondering what the heck was the significance of the loaf of bread and the sun, your guess is as good as mine. All we know is that clearly was an indicator of the brothers' destiny to rule. And as we now know, the king was right to be alarmed. The brothers subdued their neighboring tribes in Macedon, and Perdiccas became the founding member of the Temenid dynasty. Interestingly, from this legend, the Virginia sun became a symbol of Macedonian sovereignty. Under Perdiccas' rule, the Macedonians expand, though we aren't sure of the details. All we know is that Perdiccas is succeeded by Argos, Philip I, Oropos I, and Alcetus. We don't know much about them, and they're not of consequence for this story as a result. Following Alcetus was Amyntas I, ruling from 540 BC to 498 BC. It's under his reign we see another spurt of expansion in Macedonia. I don't want to confuse you with details. Suffice it to say, he expands to part of the Axios River and into parts of Upper Macedonia. How is Amyntas able to accomplish territorial expansion? In 513, King Darius of Persia forayed into Europe and conquered through Thrace and crushed the Paeonians. The Paeonians were a tribe that at the time inhabited the extremely fertile Axios and Strymon Valley, which is all along the Macedonian Sea. With the Paeonians out of the picture, and the Thracians to the east pacified by Darius, Amyntas gave earth and water, a token of submission, to the Persians. By doing this, Macedonia is able to expand their influence in the region and occupy that critical geographic and cultural crossing point between east and west that we talked about earlier. And it points to something that Macedonian kings will be known for from now on, their diplomatic prowess and the ability to play off more powerfully competing states to maintain Macedonian autonomy, sometimes with varying degrees of success. Amyntas' decision to subjugate Macedon to Persia comes back to haunt later rulers. His son, Alexander I, not to be confused with Alexander the Great, who is actually Alexander III, betrayed himself as secretly working with the Greeks, helping the Greeks despite Macedonian submission to Persia. Above all else, Alexander did not want to be viewed as being Medized, a pejorative term used by Greeks against those who betrayed their brethren by collaborating with the hated Persians. The reason why this is more important to him than his father is that his rule is during a time when Persians are in retreat from Greece, and Persian loyalty is a liability. As an aside, from Alexander I onward, Macedonian kings style themselves as Greeks, both of descent and culture. Portraying Macedonian history as Greek and anti-Persian motivated rulers all the way to when Philip II begins his invasion plans for Persia. An example of Alexander trying to spin history just like this is when he portrays the treasonous story of his father providing earth and water to the Persians. This telling is given to us by Herodotus, who no doubt received it from Alexander I himself. And where possible, I want to give you the great tales, often with a moral bent to them, from the ancient sources. And so my apologies, but this is quite a passage. To me, it reads almost as an adult bedtime story, telling a moral lesson while conveying an important piece of lore or shared history. From the landmark translation of Herodotus the Histories, Herodotus tells us the following. Quote, "And so when the Persians arrived at the court of Amyntas, they came into his presence and demanded he give earth and water to King Darius. He in fact offered to do this and invited them to be his guests for dinner. Amyntas then had a magnificent feast prepared and entertained the Persians in a spirit of friendliness. As they lingered drinking, the Persians said, 'Macedonian hosts, we, Persians, customarily bring our concubines and wedded wives to sit beside us whenever we serve a big feast. Now, since you have welcomed us so warmly and are entertaining us so generously, as well as having agreed to offer earth and water to King Darius, we urge you to follow our custom.' To this, Amyntas replied, 'Persians, this is certainly not our custom here. Indeed, we keep the men segregated from the women. But since you are now our masters and have made this additional request, we shall accommodate you in this also.' Having said that, Amyntas sent for the women, who came when they were summoned, and one after the other, they took their seats opposite the Persians. But after the Persians took one look at these beautiful women, they told Amyntas what he had done with them was not wise at all. It would have been better for the women not to have come at all, than to have them come and not sit them besides the men, but opposite of them instead, so that the men's eyes were painfully dazzled. And so Amyntas, who felt compelled to do so, ordered the women to sit beside the men. The women obeyed, and immediately the Persians, now quite intoxicated, began to fondle their breasts, and every now and then tried to kiss them. Amyntas looked on and found all this very hard to bear, but made no move because of his fear of the Persians. His son Alexandros, or Alexander, was also present and observed what was happening. Since he was young and had never before been exposed to such evils, he could no longer contain himself, and overwhelmed with indignation, he blurted out to Amyntas, "Father, yield to your age. Do not stay here and continue to drink, but go off and rest. I shall remain right here and supply your guests with everything they need." To this, Amyntas replied in full awareness that Alexandrus was intending to do something quite rash. "Son, you are almost on fire with anger, and I understand that you really wish to send me away so that you can do something radical. Now I want you to do nothing that will provoke these men, which might lead to our destruction. Instead, you must look on and endure it. But I agree I should leave." And after communicating these wishes to his son, Amyntas did indeed depart. And Alexandros said to the Persians, "My guests, these women are at your disposition. You have only to decide whether you want to have intercourse with all of them or just some of them. But right now, since it is nearly time for bed, and I see that your wine has made you splendidly drunk, send those women away to bathe, and then if you wish, welcome them back again after they've bathed." When he had finished speaking, the Persians consented to his suggestions, and the women left. Alexandros sent them off to the women's quarters, while he himself found some smooth-chinned young men, enough to equal the prior number of women, and dressed them up in women's clothing. He then gave each of them a dagger, and brought them into the Persians, to whom he now said, "Persians, it seems that your entertainment shall be a banquet complete to its last course. You have now received everything. We were already giving you everything we had, when we discovered that we could provide an addition, and so now everything is yours, and in particular, you get the greatest gift of all. We lavishly bestow upon you our mothers, our sisters. We do this so that you may realize how completely we honor you exactly as you deserve, but also that you may report to the king who sent you that a Hellene, his governor of the Macedonians, has welcomed you warmly with both bed and board." Having said this, Alexandros seated each Macedonian man in the guise of a woman beside a Persian. And when the Persians tried to touch them, they, the Macedonian men, set out by doing away with them. And it was not only these men who suffered this fate, but all their servants as well, for they had brought with them carriages and attendants and supplies for all their needs. All of these vanished, along with those who attended the banquet. Not much later, the Persians launched an intensive search for these men, but Alexandros put a stop to it with his cleverness. He gave a large amount of money, as well as his own sister, who named was Gygaea, to the Persian called Bubaris, the general in charge of those searching for the lost men. Thus repressed, the circumstances of the death of those Persians were kept secret. Although there is obvious contention and suspicion for this story, it's believed that it is possible that Gygaeus did marry Bubaris, and their son held some prominence in Persia in an official capacity as he grew older. It would also help explain one of the reasons why the Macedonians experienced such favorable turns with their Persian masters. The story is instructive in other ways, though. This is the first recorded instance of one of the Macedonians' prized diplomatic weapons, marriage. Macedonians were polygamous, and we will see Philip II would personally engage a number of diplomatic marriages to seal off peace or alliance during his reign. Holding multiple wives had an added benefit of producing multiple chances for an heir for boys and daughters who could be used to help cement ties. Amyntas' reign ended in 498, and he passed the reign on to Alexander I, the hero of our story. Alexander I will lead the Macedonians to the height of their power to date by capitalizing on the Persian retreat following the defeat at Plataea. He's the progenitor of a host of successors who find maintaining their rule after their great father's life challenging. As a dramatic succession follows, he is also the great-grandfather of Philip II and is the last king until Philip II who expands Macedonian territory. Next time on Empire, Heir to Achilles II, Alexander the Philhellene. Thank you for listening to the first ever episode of Empire History Podcast. Seriously, thank you. If you enjoyed this show, please take a few seconds to leave a review and rate it on iTunes. How often can you say you are at the ground level of the show, a dedicated fan from the beginning? Also, if you have any suggestions, constructive criticism, positive adulations, please, whatever, email me at empirehistorypodcast@gmail.com or comment on our website, EmpireHistoryPodcast.com. Until then.